From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. Nearly 500,000 people have now died from COVID-19 in the United States. That's more than the number of U.S. battlefield deaths in World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War combined.
There is some hopeful news, however. The average daily number of cases in the U.S. has dropped by more than 40% in the last 2 weeks. And the CDC said yesterday that around 43 million people have received at least one dose of a vaccine. Dr. Peter Hotez is dean at Baylor's National School of Tropical Medicine in Houston. Dr. Hotez, welcome. It's good to speak with you again.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And could you reflect on this staggering death toll that is upon us now? 500,000 people. Back in March, did you ever think it would get to this point?
I really didn't. I thought as a nation, we could do a far better job handling this. And it's just so I'm just filled with such profound sorrow and grief at this absolutely staggering loss of life. And it's not, remember, it's not only just the 500,000 who've lost their lives, but the social and economic impact on their families. And then all of the individuals who now are experiencing long haul COVID. And we're not out of this yet. You know, some projections say we're going to get up to 600 and 650,000 by the end of May and June.
And what do you think of those projections for May and June? Do you think they're realistic? I mean, what's your worst case scenario?
Yeah, well, the good news is the numbers are starting to decline precipitously in terms of new cases, and for reasons that we don't entirely understand. Some say it's due to we're not testing as much as we were. I think there may be a seasonal component to it. Others say that it's we're finally getting it in terms of social distancing and staying apart. So that's the potentially good news, that if it is going down, the bad news is now we've got this terrible variant coming from the United Kingdom, which is more transmissible. And now the UK government has put up information that it's more serious or even deadly. So I'm holding my breath because now it's about 10%, I think even more percent of the isolates in Florida, same in Southern California.
Well, Dr. Anthony Fauci was asked about that variant on CNN this weekend. And here is his response about what it could mean for the weeks and months ahead.
I think you always want to be prepared for that type of thing. I don't think at all that it is inevitable that that will happen. The way you mitigate against that is you do two things. You continue to abide by the public health measures and recommendations of universal wearing of masks, keeping physical distance, avoiding congregate settings, particularly indoors.
Fauci was responding there to a prediction that those variants would cause a devastating spike again in the coronavirus. What do you think? Do you agree? I mean, how much of a threat are those variants to your mind?
Well, it was clearly dealt a devastating blow to the British people. Whether it does the same in the United States, it's anyone's best guess. But I think, you know, as Dr. Fauci says, we've got to be prepared for it. And yes, all the things he said about social distancing and masks is correct. But for me, the other big piece to this is we've got to accelerate our ability to vaccinate the American people. We need to look at the timetable of fully vaccinating by the fall and say, I'm not sure that's good enough, and try to see if we can do this in a faster time frame.
Well, that's been very hard to do across the country, especially in places across Texas where you are. And Houston, of course, were just crushed by the brutal winter weather last week, and millions of vaccine dose shipments were delayed.
Yeah, no question.
How is the catch-up effort going?
No question. There's going to have to be a catch-up effort. We took a pretty big hit. I think there are some things that we can do if we can. We've done a lot better in terms of opening up additional vaccination hubs, not relying exclusively on the pharmacy chains and the hospital chains. And they've done a good job. I just don't think that's adequate to vaccinate at the rate we need to. So opening up some of the large hubs, the sports stadiums, community centers, and also streamlining some of the guidelines. We have to make this easy breezy to vaccinate as many people as possible. We also have to get more vaccines out there. We need that J&J vaccine. We need the Novavax vaccine. We're not going to do this with mRNA vaccines alone. And I understand we're sitting on millions of doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. This might be the time now to let it out and let's vaccinate as fast as we can ahead of the variant.
When do you expect we might get that next vaccine approved?
Well, they say the J&J is going to be the first one up in the next week or two. I'm hoping J&J will request emergency use authorization. But then again, you know, one of the disappointments that we're slowly learning about with Operation Warp Speed was, you know, we've been hearing all year, and I've been talking all year about this concept of manufacturing at risk, meaning that as soon as we know a vaccine is going to be released for emergency use authorization, we'll have the doses already produced and ready to distribute. Unfortunately, now we're learning that was more of an aspirational goal, and we're hearing from some that we may not have even 30 million doses of the J&J vaccine until April and 100 million until June. So a number of us are looking at what other levers we can pull and push to get more vaccine out there. And as I said, if it's true, and again, I don't have any inside information that the AstraZeneca vaccine is available. It's already been released by for emergency use by the World Health Organization, by the EMA, the European Regulatory Authority. I think we need to revisit that in the U.S.
Dr. Peter Hotez, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College in Houston, thanks as always for your time. Long road ahead, so we appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
A lot of Colorado politicians are trying to get the Biden administration's attention these days. The governor, a couple of senators, local leaders, they all want to talk about the future of the Bureau of Land Management. The BLM manages hundreds of millions of acres of public lands with multiple uses, from recreation to oil and gas. BLM headquarters relocated about a year ago from Washington, D.C. to Grand Junction, Colorado. The idea of the move received bipartisan support, but the way it was done has led to a lot of second guessing. As Colorado Public Radio's Caitlin Kim reports, while Colorado leaders are pushing for the headquarters to remain in state, the Biden administration may have other ideas.
Robin Brown is proud of her city. The executive director of the Grand Junction Economic Partnership thinks the federal government should keep its Bureau of Land Management headquarters in, well, Grand Junction. It's been a boon to the local economy.
The jobs and their high-wage jobs and the cachet that comes with being the home of the BLM headquarters.
But others take a dimmer view of the move out west. Scott Braden is director of the Colorado Wildlands Project.
The move caused a lot of damage to the agency, so I feel like it hasn't been a fully functional headquarters.
According to the Interior Department, of the 328 D.C.-based BLM headquarters employees slated to move across the West, only 41 did. The rest, just over 87%, retired or found work elsewhere. Some would say trimming the size of government is a good thing. But for Aaron Weiss, deputy director of the Center for Western Priorities, these numbers confirmed his worst fears.
The headquarters move was not a move. It was simply an evisceration of the agency.
Weiss says the Trump administration scattered BLM headquarters jobs across the West, in essence decentralizing the agency and losing a lot of knowledgeable people in the process. So, what's the Biden administration to do? Steve Ellis worked for the BLM for 38 years, rising to become deputy director of operations before he retired. He has some suggestions.
Don't look in the rearview mirror, but look forward. Focus on the future. Solidify what you want the BLM to be, and then organize around that.
Some conservation groups want the president to move the BLM's headquarters back to Washington, D.C. Others advocate a more surgical approach, leaving a western headquarters or hub in Grand Junction. Nada Culver with the National Audubon Society says the department should not uproot people who did make the move out west or were hired there.
Because we don't want to make the same mistakes of having some, you know, immediate edict that says, and now you shall all have to move.
During a teletown hall, Republican Representative Lauren Boebert touted her work to keep BLM in her district. She has a different view of where senior leaders should be.
It only makes sense to have the people managing hundreds of millions of acres of land located near that land and accessible to those communities.
Boebert has written a letter to the Biden administration that other House Republicans like Colorado's Ken Buck and Doug Lamborn signed on to. Aaron Weiss doesn't expect it to have much impact.
Lauren Boebert has zero sway with the Biden administration.
It's not just that she's a Republican or a freshman, but her combative tweets to objecting to the election certification don't set her up as someone the administration could negotiate with.
And that's certainly not a good starting point when it comes to BLM headquarters.
That leaves Colorado's Democrats to make the case for Grand Junction. And the state's governor and its two senators have already written the Biden administration. Robin Brown from the Grand Junction Economic Partnership organized a roundtable with state and local officials from both parties to keep BLM headquarters, or at least part of it, in Grand Junction.
I think the only thing that will save the BLM headquarters in Grand Junction is a true bipartisan effort from the entire Colorado delegation, a coordinated effort.
That might be easier said than done, given the current personalities. The Interior Department said in a statement that new leadership will work with BLM career staff to understand the ramifications of the headquarters move and determine if adjustments need to be made. For Here and Now, I'm Caitlin Kim.
And just this morning, the National Audubon Society's Nada Culver was named Deputy Director for Policy and Programs of the BLM. One year ago today, Italy was scrambling to respond to the first locally transmitted coronavirus infections outside of Asia. The news in the city of Codogno sent panicked residents to schools to pick up their children, to stores to stock up on food and supplies, and to pharmacies for surgical masks. The BBC's Mark Lowen joins us from Rome. He went to Codogno in February 2020, and he joins us again. Mark, welcome back.
Thanks, Jane. Nice to talk to you.
Well, remind us what it was like one year ago and how scared people were.
It was a very strange moment because we started getting reports about a cluster of locally transmitted cases up in the north around this town that really very few people outside Italy would probably ever heard of, Codogno. And we went up there. It was about a 6-hour drive up from Rome. And that was where we started thinking, do we wear a mask? Do we wear gloves? We started seeing police closing off roads and hearing about the term red zone and lockdown for the first time. And you got the sense that this was something very, very foreign to, and when I say foreign, I don't mean coming from abroad. I mean something that is very unknown to Western civilizations and something that had the potential, of course, to build. And of course, it did. And so there was a real sense of panic in that town and in the 9 other towns around it that were also subject to the first lockdown, that they were running out of supplies. We were speaking by video call to residents inside the town who were telling us that only pharmacies and supermarkets were open. And I remember, Jane, one of the first things that I saw the next day when we stayed up there was we went to the barrier, the cordon off zone, before the town, and I saw a man drive up to it from the kind of free side of it, let's say, and hand over a pack of face masks to his sister, who was living inside the red zone because they had run out at the pharmacy. And I watched the scene and I thought, yeah, this is really like a scene from almost come from a World War II movie where, you know, supplies were delivered into towns that were cordoned off. And of course, it was really like a war. And that's what all the doctors were telling us, that this was the start of something that they hadn't seen really since wartime.
Right. And Italy would eventually go on a severe lockdown, but the death toll continued to climb. As we said, it's now over 95,000. What's the state of the pandemic in Italy now, a year later?
The country is still split into different color zones. Red is the most severe, orange is middle, and then and yellow and white are less severe. And even in the last couple of weeks, a few more towns have been re-added to the red zone because there is a worry about the British variant that is spreading in some parts of the country, and the South African variant too has been seen. So it is much more under control than it was, and the Italian health system has rebuilt a lot and has added to its capacity very much. You might remember those early scenes of the Italian hospitals really at breaking point when there was a sort of relaxation, I suppose, of the virus over the summer, last summer. It allowed the Italian health system to reinforce itself. It also made people a bit complacent, which then led to a second wave over the winter. We're not yet seeing a third wave here, but there is the fear of a third wave. And I think really what the overriding thing that has stuck in Italians' minds is that they were the first out of China to be hit so badly, to be crushed by the virus. They were the first to have a national lockdown. And that has stuck in their minds that, you know, they know what this means. They know the impact of coronavirus. And so they're more liable to just follow instructions than perhaps others. But it's also stayed in the minds of everyone around the world. It's kind of, in a sense, elevated the Italian story to, you know, one of the most memorable parts of the pandemic.
Well, that's interesting. And so would you say then people are generally getting vaccinated in Italy?
The vaccination program is progressing. We're sort of, I think we're still in the over 80s being vaccinated here. And they're just hoping that they can speed up because, of course, they know that this is the only thing that will allow them to get back to any sense of normality here.
And stores and schools, Mark, are they open? Are restrictions still in place?
Well, for example, the region that I'm speaking to you from, Lazio, around Rome, is yellow, which means that shops are open as normal. Restaurants, bars and cafes are open until 6 p.m. for table service and then only for takeaway after that. And some schools are open, some older schools for older children are not. But I think that, you know, even the businesses that could operate now, many of them are not because they have just been ruined by this. The economic catastrophe is so dire. And there are also kind of deeper impacts. Like, for example, the Italian birth rate is now the lowest since the unification of Italy in 1861. Mm. And that's already in a country that is has got the second or third oldest average population in the world. So there are deep, deep impacts from all of this that will be felt for many generations to come. Mm.
A long year and the impacts do continue. The BBC's Mark Lowen in Rome. Mark, thank you and take care.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Rebuild, from the soundtrack to Judas and the Black Messiah, the critically acclaimed film about Black Panther leader Fred Hampton. The film's 40-year-old director, Shaka King, chose his uncle, a Harlem jazz musician, to compose the score. John Kalish tells us how it came about.
As a kid, director Shaka King learned about the history of the Black Panther Party from books and films, but his uncle Craig Harris lived through that time. Harris, who is now 67, was in high school when Fred Hampton was killed during a raid on his home by Chicago police and the FBI in 1969.
I had my fatigue jacket and my beret, like everybody else. I was part of this movement.
Harris's younger brother was in the Panthers, and Harris went to a college on Long Island where the Young Lords, a militant Puerto Rican group inspired by the Panthers, was formed. After college, Harris began his career as a jazz trombonist and performed with Sun Ra just before his nephew Shaka was born.
He's known me all of his life, and he's known the artist I am, and he got this opportunity to do this film. He said, "You're going to do the music for this film."
Because Harris had never scored a feature film before, he decided to bring in the L.A.-based composer Mark Isham, who has scored more than 100 films. They planned to improvise the score, an approach taken in 1958 for the Louis Malle film Elevator to the Gallows. Miles Davis and a group of musicians improvised its score while watching scenes from the movie. Harris and Isham were set to record the score for Judas and the Black Messiah last March, but the pandemic delayed the sessions until late September. During the delay, the post-production team temporarily used a theme by the late saxophonist Rahsaan Roland Kirk that allowed them to continue editing the film.
This was a piece that Shaka has supposedly played the studio before the script was even finished, when he's pitching the idea. That's how long this piece had sat with him.
Mark Isham.
There was going to be no dissuading him that this was going to play a major role in the music. And once I saw Shaka's commitment to it, we set out to just say, well, how can we use this? How do you expand this? How do you give a different emotional tones to it?
We did different interpolations of it. We iced it, miced it, diced it, and it's the lead piece in the film.
It really is chilling when I hear it. I just get goosebumps.
Jim Anderson is the Grammy Award-winning engineer tapped to record and mix the Judas and the Black Messiah score.
When the Warner Brothers logo comes up, the first sound you hear is the score. And it's this kind of dark, brooding orchestra setting up the tone for the rest of the movie, saying, this is going to be a very serious story coming up.
The score was recorded in a cavernous Manhattan ballroom with a number of pandemic precautions. 60 string players were socially distanced on the ballroom floor, necessitating the use of many more microphones. Woodwind players were surrounded by triangular fiberglass baffles on the ballroom stage. They watched on video monitors as Craig Harris conducted 50 yards away.
The music was all in plastic sheets. You couldn't touch it. You had to put it on the stands. And everybody, once their music was on the stands, then they could touch it.
Director Shaka King commissioned the Detroit hip-hop artist Quelle Chris and record producer Chris Keys to create additional tracks for the score. Once again, Mark Isham.
It was probably a score that I've done that has the most disparate elements. And that's why I was so pleasantly surprised, because I felt that it made sense. You know, it felt like a cohesive statement.
Judas and the Black Messiah is generating Oscar buzz in all the major categories, including Best Picture. But because less than 60% of the music in the film is original, its score won't qualify for an Academy Award. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
One of the premier science fiction writers of the 20th century, Octavia Butler imagined worlds that were radically different and strikingly similar to the one we live in today.
For our Black History Month special series, The Cautionary Tales and the Reasons for Hope that Octavia Butler left us.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Extreme winter weather has strained an already overwhelmed healthcare system. In recent days, Texas hospitals struggled without water to treat seriously ill patients. And forget about elective surgeries, procedures like hip replacements or rotator cuff repairs that are life-enhancing, but not life-saving. Thousands of those surgeries have been canceled because of COVID, and it's something that our own Robin Young has been learning about firsthand. A lot of people have been asking me, where is Robin? Well, she's right here. Robin, hello.
How are you? Yes, I am here.
I'm well.
Healing. I finally had a
right.
Long...
You're healing from a long postponed knee replacement, Robin. You're okay?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look. This is not an illness or a disease. This is an upgrade. Yes, it was canceled three times, and then Peter suddenly, bam, an opening. It's like you're going in tomorrow. But I want to rush to say, it feels like the least important thing in the world right now. As I told our friends at Stat, the health publication, they did a deep dive on this. You know, I would gladly give up a bed for someone struggling to breathe. But what I learned from Stat is that these cancellations are not inconsequential.
Well, no, I mean, I hear you. Of course, a COVID patient would and should take priority over elective surgeries. But Robin, as you know, sometimes elective surgeries are pretty serious. I mean, a kidney dialysis can be considered elective. And if you can't use your knee, as I think was the case with you, it hurts. Mm-hmm. How were you doing while you waited?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was having trouble walking. I was living on painkillers. I would joke to my doctor, the fabulous Dr. Burke, you know, you're going to get me a knee, but I will lose a kidney from all the ibuprofen I was taking. This is the hereditary loss of cushioning cartilage that leads to bone-on-bone pain. My poor grandma, was bow-legged. She didn't have this option. This is a miracle. But yeah, you know, Peter, I was shocked to learn that some organ transplants are considered elective, and there are people who can't walk at all because of this deteriorating joint pain, and then they were further isolated by COVID. They can't get out to get food. Stat reporter Elizabeth Cooney, you know, says elective doesn't mean optional. This isn't like a facelift. It just means you won't die if you put it off, but it can be tough.
I'm sure, yeah. Were the cancellations we're talking about happening because there were just so many COVID cases, or was there more to it than that?
Well, last spring, I learned, there just wasn't enough PPE or COVID tests to cover non-COVID patients coming into hospitals. You know, you don't want to bring in somebody with COVID. And then nurses and doctors were getting sick. There weren't enough to do these surgeries. Now you have to be COVID tested, at least in my hospital, before you go in for surgery, so there's more security. Yeah. But some people are still canceling themselves rather than go in because they're afraid of COVID.
Well, I mean, that I would be thinking about that if I were in a hospital. Yeah. Did you worry about getting COVID inside?
Well, I have to tell you, my ward was historically all orthopedic, but I could see it was filled with COVID cases. You saw the hazard signs on the doors. But no, because, you know, I was double masked. There's ventilation. As one nurse said to me, look, at least here, nurses are not treating both the COVID and the orthopedic patients. You're protected there. But at least here, you know where the COVID is, right? In the supermarket, you could be standing right next to somebody and not know it. So you just always had to be protective. Yeah.
Robin, the irony here is that our dear colleague Karen Miller Medson, one of our producers, is also recovering from a knee surgery right now. We're going to have two new knees on staff.
Of course
I think we're going to be all good to go.
I needed her to produce my knee replacement. Karen and I have been doing this as buddies. It's great. But we miss you all, Peter. We miss you.
Robin, we miss you so much. Great to hear your voice.
You too.
Swimmer for the USA is Derek Torres, and Torres has taken second place right away. USA with Torres swimming the anchor leg wins the bronze medal.
What were your thoughts? You're on the blocks. You're a little bit behind East Germans. Do you think you had a chance to catch her?
No, I think they're a little too far out ahead, but I just gave my best shot.
Swimmer Dara Torres won 12 Olympic medals, the first when she was 17, the last when she was 41. But success in the pool early on in her career hid struggles with a serious eating disorder. And she talks about that in depth for the first time in a documentary that airs tonight on the SEC Network. It's called Once Upon a Comeback. Dara Torres joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you for having me. Gosh, my voice sounded so young there. I don't even know which year that was, but it had been a long time ago.
Well, you were young. I mean, the film opens with your comeback ahead of the Olympics in Beijing in 2008, but I want to start way back where you did. How did you get into swimming in the first place, Dara?
Well, I have four older brothers, and I was very competitive from the minute I was born. It was like, who could be the first one in the car? Who could be the first one done at the dinner table? Just always competing with them. Whatever they would do, I would do. So the minute they started on a swim team, and my mother had me in the stands, that didn't go very well because I had a lot of energy. And I think back then they called it hyperactivity, but I'm sure I had ADD. And she put me in the pool just to get the energy out and not have it, you know, all around her and just focus it somewhere. So I started swimming and just fell in love with the sport.
So always wanted to be first, competitive as anyone around. Did it come easy for you at first?
It really did. I really could just get up on the starting blocks and do the start into the water and swim fast and no big deal. And I think that all changed when I started to notice changes in my body, started to become more of a woman and realize that I actually have to work hard to be fast. It's just not, doesn't come easy anymore.
Well, the University of Florida had a great swimming program, and that's where you went to college. You were incredibly successful there, too. But that's where the trouble started. There was a lot of pressure from your coaches, especially your coach, Randy Reeves, to lose weight. I want to ask you about that pressure. How did that pressure turn into an eating disorder at that time, Dara?
Well, you know, in all fairness to Randy and the other coaches there, this was the 80s. They didn't really know a lot about eating disorders. I didn't tell them I had an eating disorder, so I kept it hidden from them. What happened was, is we had a coach who believed that if you looked intimidating on the starting blocks, you would intimidate your competitors. So he thought we should weigh a certain amount. And each week we had to sort of make weight, I guess you should say, and he would weigh us. And if we didn't make weight, we had to do extra workouts. Well, for me personally, having come from a background where I've never trained like that before in my life, to have to do extra workouts was just, that wasn't going to happen for me. And one thing kind of led to another. I sort of got in this habit of binging and purging in my freshman year. And that's kind of how it all started and just sort of snowballed from there.
You talk about the coaches weighing you. I mean, the coaches weighed the girls right there on the pool deck. As you describe in the film, I mean, sometimes these girls would just break down in tears right there if they didn't make weight. This was intense pressure.
It definitely was a lot of pressure. But you have to remember, it wasn't something that they put on us. Like, I put that pressure on me. I am a pleaser. I need to please everyone. I need to please my coaches. My coach, this coach in particular, is really the only coach who wasn't the most complimentary coach. Like, if he said something positive to you, then you knew you really did something great. And I wasn't used to that. So I just wanted to do what he wanted us to do, which was to make weight. And I couldn't do it just by not eating. It's like I had to find another way to do it. And this is all on me. And I take full responsibility for it. But yes, it was something that I wasn't used to in that type of environment.
So the binging and the purging, the eating disorder essentially overtook your entire life, your entire psyche. And as you say in the film, it led you to a very, very dark place.
It did. And it was probably the darkest time of my life. It's funny because I had someone recently interview me and ask me, you know, if you didn't have that eating disorder, would things have been a lot different? And, you know, for me, if I hadn't had that going on and I had happened to win the medal that I wanted to win back in college, I wouldn't have been in the sport as long as I was. So it was obviously a very dark time in my life, and I wouldn't wish that upon my worst enemy. But yet I learned a lot from it, and it made me the person who I am today.
In the film, you go back years later and you speak to the women's swim team at Florida. I want to play a clip of what you told them.
The reason why I'm talking about this to you guys is because there are a lot of young women who have issues like this, whether it's being bulimic, anorexic, or just having a fear of food because you don't want to gain weight. The biggest advice that I would give any of you, if any of you are experienced or know anyone who's experienced it, is to don't be afraid to talk about it.
So eventually, Dara, you recognize that you did indeed need help. Tell us how you started the process of healing.
Well, I tried to talk to a male team doctor about it, and I think he didn't know. This is while I was at UF. I don't think he knew like how to deal with that or what to say. So next time I ended up seeing him at a practice or whatever it was, he handed me this information on eating disorders, and that was that. There was nothing else talked about. And so I still was kind of stuck. And so that is a big advice, is to talk about it. And it took me until after I graduated college, my mom had asked me to go get a physical, and the doctor who was giving me the physical at the end of the physical started asking me all these questions. And one of them was, have you ever binged and purged? And I said, no. And then I left, and I felt so guilty that I lied to her, that I had to call her and say, okay, yeah, actually I do have a problem. And I'm sorry that I lied to you about this. And then that's when the first step was opening up about it. And it was a huge relief, although I knew I had a lot of work to do after that, but it was a huge relief to get it off my shoulders after 4 years of only me knowing that I had this issue.
So you kept swimming, the Olympics in 1988 in Seoul, Barcelona in 1992, Sydney in 2000. And then in your 40s, you are pregnant, Dara, and you start training for the 2008 Olympics. Why again? What more did you have to prove?
Well, I really was strictly swimming when I got pregnant, just for exercise. And then I got asked to swim in a meet. And I did that about 3 weeks after I had Tessa. And that was fine. And then I got asked to swim in another meet. And I swam in that. And then I started getting peer pressure of people saying, God, it wouldn't be great to see a middle-aged person in the Olympic Games. And, you know, I thought about it. And I love challenges. And I thought, wow, you know, this would be cool one day to share with my daughter if I try to do this. And I came to the conclusion that, you know, I look at working parents out there as this inspiration of being great parents, but still going out there and working. I thought, well, why can't I do that? And so I gave it a shot. I had no idea what was going to happen. But the moment that I told myself I was going to do this, I had the thought in my head that I was going to win a gold medal. And that I kept that thought with me every single day for the almost 2 years after that I trained for the Olympic trials and Olympic Games. And I really think the power of positive thinking can play a role in what you do in your life.
Well, and you won 3 silver medals in Beijing. And then in 2012, you tried to qualify for a sixth Olympic team, but you didn't make it. Did you leave the sport satisfied, Dara?
You know, I really did. It's funny because when I got out of the pool after those Olympic trials and I missed the team by 9/100ths of a second, I looked in the stands. I saw my daughter crying and I saw my mom crying. I'm like, oh my gosh, I have to go over and console them. And you know, my mom, obviously, she was upset because she's my mom and she wanted to see me, you know, make another Olympic team. But my daughter, I'm like, Tessa, what's wrong? Are you okay? She's like, now I don't get to go to London and see Michael Phelps and Ryan Lochte. I'm like, oh my gosh, she's starting way too early, you know? So it was kind of funny. It was a little bit of a role reversal of, you know, me having to console my mom, but I was okay. I knew that the time that I did Olympic trials at my sixth Olympic trials was the second fastest time I've ever done at trials, but the girls are getting faster and I couldn't give it anything else. I gave it all I had.
Speaking of your daughter, Tessa, she's 15, right?
14, yes.
14. So I'm curious what you tell your daughter about body image and the problems you experienced as a youth.
I continuously tell her how beautiful she is on the inside and out, and not to base, you know, everything off of food and, you know, just to make sure that you, when you eat, you want to eat stuff that, you know, you're maybe not supposed to have, eat it in smaller portions and you'll be fine.
That's an important message for all of us. That's a former Olympic swimmer, Olympic Hall of Famer, and mom, Dara Torres. She's the subject of the SEC story documentary, Once Upon a Comeback, that airs on the SEC Network tonight. Dara Torres, all the best to you. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
About a year into this pandemic, and we want to check back in on a story we've been following, how remote work is changing cities. Millions of Americans are working from home in the pandemic, if they're lucky enough. And in surveys, many have said that they hope to continue doing so. But a new report from the consulting firm Ernst & Young describes how devastating that would be on small businesses in the area around Washington, D.C. Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he joins us now from Washington, as he does every Monday. Derek, good to speak with you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. And can you start just by telling us more about how many people are working remotely and how many could continue to do so in the years ahead?
Based on the most recent estimates that I could find, about 40% of the workforce right now is still working from home. I should stress that that means that the majority of people in the workforce are either out of work or not working at home. So we are talking about a minority, but we're talking about a very large minority. That's tens of millions of people. And surveys suggest that about half of that 40%, you know, about 15 to 20% are still going to want to hold on to some aspect of remote work when their office reopens. For some, that'll mean they move out to the suburbs and exurbs. They basically work entirely from their kitchens and bedrooms. For others, it will be kind of a 3-2-2 situation where they'll maybe go into the office three times a week, stay home two times a week, and then stay home, obviously, for those weekends. So there's a variety of ways this could go, but most people that I'm talking to do seem to think that remote work is going to be a big part of the labor picture for us going forward.
And you have been speaking to a lot of people over the last few months, economists, architects, demographers, business owners, and you say that there are two ways, basically, that this could go. There's a pessimistic vision for our cities and an optimistic vision. So I guess we should start with the gloomier prediction here. What do you think on the gloomy perspective? What does it mean for cities?
Yeah, I guess we can start with gloomy. So for a year, we've seen more people moving out of cities like New York, San Francisco, Boston, D.C., L.A., Chicago, than moving in. We're not talking about every city here, but these are among some of the largest and richest cities in America. And if people do leave these cities, typically some higher income people, that's going to reduce the city's subway and bus revenue, which is going to lead to service cuts. And then that's going to make these places harder to live in. So more people might leave the city. Transit revenue continues to decline, and you have this kind of vicious cycle where people, you know, are leaving, depleting the urban tax base, and that kicks off a vicious cycle for some cities. So that's really the gloomy picture here.
Transportation is a big one. I mean, we're seeing some of the cutbacks already in cities, and the question is whether or not services will return to normal or when they will. I'm also thinking, Derek, about, you know, for instance, dry cleaners. I have not personally been to a dry cleaner in a year, and I'm thinking about those workers, you know, how will people shift, or will they shift, to working into other industries?
I think this is exactly the direction of thinking that we need to put front of mind. If fewer people go into downtown urban core areas, Well, that means there's going to be less work for maintenance workers. It means there's going to be less foot traffic for retail salespeople. The two most common jobs in America are still cashier and retail salesperson. What about the people waiting tables at restaurants that rely on business lunches and rely on that foot traffic? So I do think it's important to think about this systematically. What happens if people reduce their transit into downtown areas by, say, 50%? What does that do to the workforce in those downtown areas? I think this is a place where my gloomy thinking is most activated, I suppose.
But what if you were an optimist, rather?
Well, the optimistic scenario, I think, is a metaphor that I've described before, which is that of a forest fire. Cities are going through hell right now. But as with a forest fire, where you have the fire wipe out the forest, but then what grows back is often even more biodiverse and abundant than the forest that existed before the fire, we could see the same with American cities. We're seeing rents fall across a lot of urban core cities in America. Maybe that's a good thing. You know, we've had an affordability crisis in American cities for the last 10, 20 years. Maybe middle-income American families and immigrants move into these places that they couldn't afford 5 years ago, and they start this new renaissance of the American city that a lot of urban demographers have been hoping for many years. So that, I think, is the optimistic view that, yes, the cities might take a step back in terms of price levels, but that just makes it a more affordable and exciting place for lower and middle-income families to live and benefit from all the wondrous possibilities these cities have.
What do you think it might mean for office space as companies reconsider their futures?
It's really difficult to disentangle exactly what companies are planning for, because there are a lot of companies like Facebook and Amazon that seem to be talking out of two sides of their mouth, or at least seem to be saying one thing and then spending based on something else. So you have a lot of tech companies that are saying, we are embracing the remote work future. We believe that you can sort of be wherever and be productive, and we're not going to punish you for that. At the same time, Facebook and Amazon are buying up a lot of office space in Boston, in San Antonio, outside of Washington, D.C., where Amazon's second headquarters is going to be located. So on the one hand, they are saying to both the public and, I presume, to their own employees, we believe in a future that's going to allow people to work in a distributed way.
Derek,
but they're also clearly investing in the future of offices.
I got to leave it there, Derek. I'm Derek Thompson at The Atlantic. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. This is Here and Now.